So hello and welcome to the Leadership Centre series of podcasts. The Leadership Centre is a charity whose mission is to build leadership capacity across the public sector to enable positive and lasting change for citizens and society. In this series, we'll be exploring the various dimensions, challenges, opportunities and dilemmas inherent in the activity and practice of leadership in organisations and across our places.
So welcome to the third in the series of Leadership Centre podcasts. My name is Sue Goss, and today I'm joined by Christopher Pietroni, who is a Leadership Centre enabler, as I am, but he's also Senior Assistant Fellow at the Institute of Local Government Studies at the University of Birmingham, teaching leadership. So what we're going to be working on today is the personal side of collaborative leadership and the personal development, how we develop new skills and ways to find a personal journey through some of the things that we've been talking about. So the first thing I wanted to ask you, Christopher, was you and I have often talked about this idea of the leader as hero and some of the reasons for that and to question that, I guess. So I'd just like you to say a bit more of your thinking around that.
Yes, thanks, Sue. And it's great to be here and get a chance to talk through these things. So this idea of the leader as hero does seem to me to be really prevalent. It's sort of so much part of how we think about leadership that we may not even notice that it's actually part of our ideas. But I think if we think at this moment, so here we are speaking in May 2019, sitting here in London, and the one thing that is certain in a very uncertain political landscape is that the Conservative Party is going to have a leadership election in a few weeks' time. We don't know whether we're going to be leaving the European Union. We don't know what the consequences of that might be. We have no idea about where the economy is going, let alone big issues like health and social care and education. But we know we're going to get a new leader of the Conservative Party and a new prime minister, which seems to carry with it the assumption that that is going to somehow make a difference. That by changing the person at the top, these big intractable problems that are flummoxing the country and have been for many, many years are somehow going to be sorted by a change of leadership at the top. Now, my argument is not that the individual who is at the head or is seen as the leader is an irrelevance, simply that it may not be quite as centrally important as our behaviour and our attitudes tend to imagine.
But we tend to think of a leader as the person who gives direction and the person who gives certainty, and everybody else knows where they are because of the leader leading, I guess. Isn't that right?
Well, that's certainly how we tend to think about leadership. I think if you asked the public, well, in fact, the BBC did this, didn't they? They had this rather strange series of programmes which were about the great people of the 20th century, and one of them was on leaders, and the candidates for the best leaders were, wait for it, Winston Churchill, Margaret Thatcher, Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King. I mean, considerable, extraordinary individuals, every single one of them, but absolutely representing the idea of leadership that you, I think, are referring to, which is that the idea that our leaders are strong, commanding, often charismatic, decisive, visionary, embodying these extraordinary qualities. And I think the question I would want to ask is, well, how come, a whole bunch of other people who undoubtedly, changed the course of the 20th century weren't on that list? What about the women who chained themselves to railings? Not even the Pankhurst, but the women who actually did the chaining or were force-fed in the prisons. That was, I would want to argue, a kind of leadership. But we're not as drawn to that. We're not as attracted to it because it doesn't seem to provide us with the same degree of certainty and direction as those big, considerable figures. So I think I would just want to ask some questions about why are we so attracted to an idea of leadership which is basically kind of heroic in nature. And I think there are some reasons for that. I also think this goes back a very long way. It goes right back into antiquity, but let's just start with the kind of the classic articulation of this, which comes in the mid-19th century. Thomas Carlyle writes this very well-received at the time, very widely read tract, which he entitled On Hero Worship. And that wasn't ironic. He was suggesting that actually there was something really valuable in looking at these individuals from whom, if we could only study and understand and try to emulate them, we would ourselves become better sorts of people. Now, I don't think it's a coincidence that he was writing that in a Europe that was on the verge of revolution. All over Europe, there were these revolutionary movements. The Industrial Revolution was absolutely overthrowing the traditional order of things. It was very unclear the way that, you know, in the UK, the way that politics was going to go. We were in the age of universal suffrage. Everything is in flux. And what do we look for? Somebody who's going to tell us the answers and make it easier. Now, I think very often that's where we find ourselves today. The reason that we're so attracted to this notion of the hero leader, as we've been referring to it, but it can be, you know, heroine, it could be equally be a woman these days, is because it provides us with apparent order, certainty, security, direction in a world that can often feel very disorientating, quite frightening. And if we're in public service in some role, quite exposed. And so it's easier, preferable to believe that somebody else can make it okay. And in some ways that makes us feel safer. But I think even more importantly, it removes from us some of the responsibility for figuring out how to act. If somebody else can tell us, if they're the better, more well-informed visionary, and we can simply take their instruction, then it makes it a little easier for us to avoid having to ask difficult questions of ourselves about how do I need to act right now.
So hunting for a hero leader enables us to avoid responsibility for what happens next.
I think it does to some extent, yes. I mean, I think that, I mean, let's think about the sorts of situations that you know, public servants find themselves in. You know, we're trying to make sometimes seemingly impossible decisions about which deserving members of our population are going to receive services or not. Where are we going to make cuts? You know, are we going to disadvantage elderly people in our communities by reducing services for them? Are we going to disadvantage children by reducing services for them? These are deeply morally charged questions. They touch on our values. They touch sometimes on the things that matter most to us. And yet it is in the nature of the roles in public service that we can't avoid them unless we say, well, it's not really my job to figure out the way through this problem. I'm going to follow the direction given to me by my boss or my boss's boss or my boss's boss's boss. And I think that, no, I'm not criticizing that, by the way. I don't think that that is in any way a natural thing to do. In fact, I think it is the most natural thing to do. You know, as human beings, we know, you know, there's a lot of sort of social psychological research which tells us that we crave order, we crave direction, we crave authority figures who are going to give us that sense of order and direction. This is how we've been evolved. So when we see people who appear to give us that, we are attracted to them. My question is, those problems that we're trying to solve, are they more likely to be solved through that sort of top-down instruction, here's the right way of doing it? Or are they more likely to be solved if we get into the messy, complex, ambiguous, morally difficult space of trying to figure out a way forward in the absence of that sort of hero leadership?
So if we don't want to go for hero leadership all the time, and I guess as a woman, I'm always a bit anxious about a hero model, which sort of tends to be a relatively sort of male powerful figure, and that doesn't feel like my way of doing things. I feel left out of that sort of model. What other sorts of leadership are there? What else?
Sure. So just on that point about the sort of gendered nature of this, just in passing, I think that is relevant a relevant factor as well. That it's not a coincidence that our the sort of hero models of leadership that we carry tend to be masculine in nature. There's again a lot of research now which shows that if you ask people about their ideas of leadership, what they will come up with are descriptions which are stereotypically masculine. And that's a problem for women, obviously, because it means that if your idea of what a leader is basically male, then for women to assume leadership responsibilities becomes problematic. It's also a problem for men, because it traps men into a stereotyped version of leadership, which is, I said, stereotypically masculine. Now, that may not be the mode that they want to behave in or that they even think is most appropriate, but they too are in some way trapped into behaving in that way because of the ideas of leadership that we carry. So we know that this is actually a very prevalent kind of force. The ways that we imagine leaders, the assumptions that we carry about what good leadership looks like, often unexamined and often unconscious, are fairly traditional and fairly male. Your question about, so what else then? I think is exactly the right way. That's exactly the place to go, right? So the question I think that you're posing is, what is the kind of leadership that might be more effective given the world that we are working in? And my working hypothesis is that that world is characterized by uncertainty, ambiguity, a lack of clarity about the way forward, where the problems that we're dealing with, very often we can't really even agree on defining the problem, let alone on defining the solution. So childhood obesity. Well, what is the problem about childhood obesity? You know, is the problem personal responsibility? Is it food, calories? Is it unhealthy food? Is it to do with a lack of income for people to afford healthy eating? Is it a lack of exercise? We could go on. So we struggle to define the problem. We struggle even more to define what the solution is. So the question is, if a hero can't come in and tell us how to solve childhood obesity, what might? Well, that's where I think we are into the space of, you know, sometimes we call it collaborative leadership, sometimes inclusive or systems leadership. There's lots of different words that are used to describe it. But it's the kind of leadership which is understanding leadership as a different thing. Leadership not as direction, not as giving direction, but leadership as, well, one way of describing it would be leadership as a practice rather than leadership as a position. So taking responsibility for enabling a group to achieve some sort of shared purpose in uncertain times. Now, that role of leadership can be taken up by somebody who's a chief executive, somebody who is in the midpoint in an organization, somebody on the front line, or indeed somebody without any formal status at all. So it's the sort of leadership which is asking us to explore more deeply what are the underlying changes that are needed if we're going to achieve the outcomes that we want to achieve. So one person who I think has written really well on this and who's quite well known is Ron Heifetz. So he's actually based at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. And he has this notion of what he calls adaptive leadership, which is really an attempt to describe the kind of leadership that is needed in these messy, complex spaces, and particularly where what needs to change is not just, as it were, sort of processes, but what needs to change are attitudes and underlying beliefs about what is the right thing to do. How should we be behaving? What are the outcomes that we should be achieving?
But I guess, so realistically, we don't need that sort of leadership all the time. I mean, there are some practical day-to-day managerial tasks where actually the team leader or whatever they are in the organisation does know the answer and can direct. And it seems to me that that's a perfectly efficient and effective way of doing basic tasks. So what we're saying is that in some circumstances, that might not work and we might need a different sort of leadership and we need to be able to know which is which. Do you have, and I think this is probably what Heifetz refers to as the difference between technical problems and adaptive problems, and there's lots of different language, but do you have an example of when it's a technical problem where you could do it through conventional leadership direction certainty and some examples of adaptive problems where you would need that messier, more facilitative, more exploratory approach.
So I completely agree. I think this distinction between technical and adaptive is a really helpful one. And sometimes it's almost, you know, there's a sort of shorthand, which is that we can also see technical problems and management, if you like, as being on one side and adaptive problems and what I would like to think of as leadership being on the other side. So I think those things do go hand in hand. So yes, there are problems that we face, which we have faced before. We know how to deal with them. And actually, management processes are really important. So let me use an example. Let me draw on some case study work that we did based on the difficulties of child sexual exploitation in Rotherham, right? So it's a deep and powerful issue. But one of the things that's really interesting when you look at that case is that there are some issues there which are technical, and there are some issues there which we would call adaptive. So on the adaptive side, that's where we're talking about the sort of change where we don't have to change what we're doing. We have to change how we see the world. We have to change underlying values and beliefs and behaviors, really fundamental issues. On the technical side, we're sort of running processes. So in that case, there's a distinction between, as it were, the adaptive issues, which are, you know, there are any number of them, but are about how do you enable communities which have in that part of the world, deeply entrenched racial and religious tensions. And there were players who were keen to inflame those tensions on both sides, and where you have an emergent issue of child sexual exploitation, where there was an association with the community of mainly Muslim Asian men. Now, nobody in that place, there was this adaptive problem, which was, how do we even have that conversation? How can we even name that issue in a way which doesn't feel like we're stigmatizing, pointing the finger, going to give the EDL ammunition? How do we talk about sex publicly, and how do we talk about sexual exploitation of children publicly? But even more so, how do we move from a situation where early in that process, this problem wasn't even seen as child sexual exploitation, it was seen as child prostitution. The young women were seen to be child prostitutes, as if they were somehow responsible for the abuse of which they were victims. Moving from even seeing it as child prostitution to child sexual exploitation, that's adaptive. It's big and tough and adaptive work, right? Wow. Really serious stuff. But there was also management work to be done. There was technical work to be done that failed. So there's a really interesting bit of that case, which is about taxi licensing. I mean, you don't get much more local government than taxi licensing, right? Local authorities have a regulatory, statutory responsibility in relation to the licensing of taxi firms. And one of the things that we understand now, partly as a result of Rotherham, but in other parts of the country as well, was that because this was a council that was under financial pressures, that was therefore doing the sorts of things that you do, which is to look for efficiency. So they reorganized their taxi licensing functions so that they weren't any longer sort of linked up with their policy function. They sort of said, oh no, taxi licensing and policy, these are different things. We can separate them out, have fewer specialized people. But then, of course, through the reorganization, you know, communication breaks down and information doesn't flow, the data systems don't talk to each other anymore. And what you begin to find out is that actually the sorts of checks that should have taken place didn't take place. That bit of the problem is technical, not adaptive, and is amenable. And in fact, the way that that got resolved when the commissioners came in to Rotherham, the lead commissioner for taxi licensing, Dame Mary Ney now, actually went in, and Mary talks about this, you know, really operated, you know, basically applied very good management principles to ensuring that what should happen did happen and was followed through. So the final thing just to say on this, Sue, is one of the things I always like to reinforce with my students, is this distinction between technical and adaptive is not a distinction between important and unimportant. Or, you know, we mustn't fall into the trap of thinking the technical managerial stuff is not critical. In a case like that, it was absolutely critical. But even if you had got the taxi licensing arrangements right, you still would have been left with this underlying adaptive issue around child sexual exploitation. And that was the bit that nobody could find a way of looking at.
So it isn't even a matter of dealing with the two sets of issues with two different approaches. They need to talk to each other somehow. We need to be able to communicate between the two.
This is the trouble. I mean, it's hard enough, right, thinking that the world might not be, there might be technical and there might be adaptive. But the trouble is, generally, these things don't come neatly packaged. Sometimes they do, but generally, what we're actually doing is confronting a really complex problem, and there's a mix of technical and adaptive in there. And Ron Heifetz, who is the academic who coined these terms, who you referred to, you know, he has this line about, you know, the biggest failures of leadership are when we apply technical solutions to adaptive problems. So I think very often the leadership work that we have to do is to know how we tease these out. How do we notice the difference?
So give us an example of applying a technical solution to an adaptive
problem. So I'll give you a personal example. This was a sort of near career ending personal example. So about 10 years ago, I was corporate director at the local government association, and I had responsibility for corporate strategy, broadly speaking. And we were on the brink of the kind of obvious cut in public spending. So we knew we were going to have a lot less money in the future than we had had in the past. So the question arose about, well, how are we going to prepare for this? And I was given responsibility for figuring this out. And the solution that I came up with was that we would reorganize what were a group of allied bits of the local government association, some dealing with improvements, some dealing with regulations, some dealing with privatization of public services. And that rather than having five or six different organizations, we would reorganize and come into one. Because that would be cheaper and more efficient and would lead to better outcomes, we thought. And in particular, we also thought that it would enable us to kind of do our lobbying and policy work better, because it would kind of bring all these things together. Now, the problem with that was, and I mean, I won't give you the blow by blow, but you know, anybody who was around at the time will know that that didn't end happily, and I didn't actually lose my job, but it was a very difficult time because it just blew up. Now, the reason it blew up was because I was applying I was treating this as a technical problem. There is money to be saved. We need to be more efficient. We can achieve that by a rationalization of our structures and our the way that we employ and spend our money, and that will deliver us an outcome. Now, that wasn't wrong, but it just completely misdiagnosed what the problem was. The problem was that the LGA wasn't just a group of organizations. It was a kind of web of political aspirations. There was an officer perspective, there were political perspectives, there were different perspectives within the politicians about what this LGA group existed to achieve, and that this multiplicity of different organizations allowed all of those different perspectives to find an outlet. And in trying to get rid of them all and efficiently produce a new streamlined organization, a whole range of interest groups and legitimate interest would simply being trammeled. Now, what I didn't understand, what I didn't diagnose correctly, was the nature of the problem that I was dealing with, and try and come up with, rather than a technical solution, here's how we're going to get efficiency, an adaptive, more adaptive solution, which said, okay, let's understand the nature of the change that we need to go through. How do we need to adapt to the new environment that we're going to find ourselves in? Which bits of what we've already got do we need to let go of? Which bits are so important to us and our identity as a group of organizations that we need to preserve? And then where can we apply technical rationality to coming up with incremental efficiencies? That would have been a more subtle, more variegated way of thinking about the problem.
Okay, so if we buy into the idea that some problems are adaptive, although not all, and they are often problems where we don't really understand what the problem is, and we certainly don't agree about it, and they are often situations in which either no one's come up with a solution before or we're in new territory, what are the leadership things that we can do? What's What's the alternative to directing? What do leaders do in those situations?
So, so here I'd want to kind of pose a challenge, I suppose. So I think very often we were talking about authority earlier and how authority is reassuring. It tells us where to go. It protects us from danger, and it provides things for us. So in organizations, I think very often what we do is we respond to and we give people that kind of authority. And I think the sort of adaptive leadership you're talking about does different things. I don't think it tells people what to do. I think it very often asks them challenging questions, which invites them to explore what they aren't doing that perhaps they could be doing. It very often, where in organizations or in communities or when we're dealing with problems, we often want to say, oh, tell us, oh, wise one, or oh, boss, where we should go and what the answer is. The adaptive leadership response in that space would be for the senior figure, the authority figure, to say, to refuse to give an answer, but rather to turn around and to create a space in which that group of people have to talk with one another and their collaborators and stakeholders about where the answers might lie. It's often moving from a position of giving the answer to creating the conditions for further inquiry and question asking. It can feel very difficult to, if you are the person in the leadership, traditional senior leadership role, it's not what people expect you to do. So very often what you have to do, I think, if you really want to offer adaptive leadership, is to disappoint people's expectations of receiving direction and instead put them in a space where they have to do the difficult, painful, often unsettling work of figuring out what might be possible in terms of ways forward.
And I guess sometimes for staff that might feel like withholding an answer or testing them, or, you know, that if people don't feel very safe, that can often feel like they're being set up to fail. So there must be something that adaptive leaders need to do to make that situation feel okay.
Yeah, I think there are. So I think one thing, when it feels really unsafe, actually, is when you have somebody who is you know, one day offering you that more sort of adaptive style and the next day coming in and giving you the direction. So I think if you're wanting to offer your team or your organization adaptive leadership, you have to be willing to maintain it, or at least to be clear about the boundaries. And I think this is the other way about safety. So, you know, I think adaptive leadership of this kind works much best in the specific than in the abstract. So, for example, we might say as an organization, so let's go back to the issue that I mentioned earlier around childhood obesity, right? We might say, we don't know what the answer is to childhood obesity, and we're not going to try and figure that out in a darkened room, and we're not going to try and tell other people what that is. We recognize that in order to figure out how in this part of the world we're going to make progress on this, we need to get multiple stakeholders into an ongoing collaboration and conversation and series of experiments to test out what might be possible. That would be an adaptive space. And we might very deliberately describe that that's how we're going to approach it. That's what Ron Heifetz would call a holding environment. It would be putting a boundary around an area of work and saying, look, this is an adaptive space that we're going to work in. But there might be other bits of our business that actually we have to be much more deliberately directional and, if you like, technical about. And we're going to be clear that in this space, taxi licensing, it's not a conversation. It's not a collaboration. It's not a stakeholder process. It's a, here's the law. These are our statutory responsibilities. And we're going to ensure that we deliberately and effectively deliver them. And I think being clear in that way can de-risk it a bit for people.
And I guess it helps if everybody, including right down to the front line, have an understanding of the difference between technical problems and adaptive problems, so that they can suggest that that a way forward might be exploratory in this situation, and could you just give me the answer in this other situation?
So I think one of the things that is the simplest thing that any of us can do in these sorts of situations is to just explain our thinking to other people. So I think if we're trying to offer a particular kind of leadership or trying to address a problem in a particular kind of way, sometimes. And I know I've done this in the past when I've been in senior leadership roles. I felt like it was my job to have the answer and to show up and give it. I didn't feel confident enough to turn up and share with a group, I'm not really sure what the way forward is with this, but here are some things that I think might help us. What do you think? And I think there's sometimes just simple shifts like that that create a different kind of conversation and environment, which make it a little more possible for people.
And I think what's interesting, I was just thinking about this because I was reflecting on a moment not very long ago where one of my staff came up and said, and don't give us any of that coaching shit, just tell us what to do because we've only got 3 hours. And it was a sense, it was they were making a judgment call about what sort of leadership they wanted, and it was as much for them to choose the leadership that might be needed as it was for me to choose it, and that felt okay.
See, I think sometimes it is. What that reminded me of is I lived with a writer for many years, and they would share their drafts with me, and I, before giving comment, which I was always asked for, I would always say, now, what sort of comment do you want from me? Is this the sort of, do you want encouragement comment, or do you really want critical comment? And so, yes, I agree. I think that is important. And I think to some extent, as followers, and by the way, I don't think we talk nearly enough about good followership, but as followers, you know, we can ask for the sort of leadership we want. But sometimes I think leadership, true leadership, requires, even when people want you, sometimes when people most want you, to tell them what to do is actually when you have to disappoint them. Heifetz talks about disappointing people at a rate they can tolerate. So it's the rate they can tolerate bit that is the art of this, I think.
And he talks also about regulating the temperature.
Yeah.
Talk a bit about that for us.
Yeah, so this is partly drawing actually on insights from the world of how do adults learn. And one of the things we know is that actually for us to learn new things, we have to be a bit kind of shaken up. We have to, in some way, particularly when these are ingrained habits and beliefs, we have to get enough what Heifetz calls disequilibrium. We have to be challenged enough that the pre-existing assumptions that we're carrying are brought into question, and then we can be open to seeing the world in a different kind of a way. So that's that sort of challenge that often goes along with adaptive leadership, you know, pointing out that the way that we're doing things, you know, aren't working, and how they're not working, and who they're failing, and the various kinds of ways, not tolerating simply doing things the way we've always done them. But that's very disturbing for individuals and organizations. So whilst we might need to turn up the temperature, make things more challenging, stir things up a bit, be deliberately provocative, sometimes even create deliberate managed conflict, because it's only when we're actually having a clash of ideas or perspectives that new thinking can occur. That's the temperature up bit. But if you keep the temperature up there all the time, it's exhausting for people. And also, if you turn it up too much, it explodes and you have crises and people leave or lose their jobs, or, you know, morale gets so low that people kind of don't want to, you know, be in the organization anymore. So that's the idea of regulating the kind of heat in the system. So how do we turn the heat down? We can turn the heat down by focusing on technical problems. So actually doing things that we know how to do is one way of managing the sort of degree of disequilibrium in the system. Sometimes, you know, adaptive work is really hard. It's really hard, and it's not short term. And the problems, and actually, you know, Heifetz would say you don't solve an adaptive problem anyway. You only ever make progress on it. So it's never going away. It's just something that you're constantly working at. But sometimes in the life of organizations, they are not in a fit state to deal with some of the most difficult adaptive problems. So sometimes I think it is a perfectly reasonable thing to do for somebody in a position of leadership to deliberately provide a more technical solution or focus on a technical aspect of what they know is an adaptive problem, because they know that in the life of the organization, people are not in a, the temperature needs to be dialed down. People need to have more certainty. So we might sometimes, and I hope this doesn't sound either dishonest or manipulative. It's not intended to be either. But I think it is sometimes the responsibility of leadership to say, you know what, this is the most that we can do right now. It's not everything that needs to be done. But right now, we're going to focus on this more technical element to make us overall more able to deal with what we need to deal with.
But I think that's different from pretending it's a technical problem all the way through. And I think that the danger is, for particularly working in the public sector, is that we are so committed to a way of doing things that involves writing papers and drawing diagrams and coming up with action plans. And there's an awful lot of paperwork before we actually do anything in the real world. And the idea of just creating a messy space in which people explore together. I mean, I've been doing some work in a London borough, and we've got these messy spaces. But my God, the anxiety that creates, because people want the action plan. They want the paper they can take to members. They want the thing that, you know, shows that they've got somewhere. And it, every time we try and do something, something else happens, new people turn up, the service users want to do something else. It can feel very anxious making to be in that messy space.
So I think I agree with that, absolutely. Totally agree that being intentional about regulating the heat is different from pretending that an adaptive problem isn't there or misdiagnosing it. These are different elements. And I also agree that, you know, we struggle with the sort of messy, uncertain experimentation that you've just described as being part of what it is to be a public servant. You know, the idea that we carry often about what is it to be a local government officer or a manager in the NHS or a civil servant or whatever it might be, we think in terms of kind of process, agendas, meetings, decisions, and all of these things. Now, there are good reasons for those things. You know, we need to be accountable. We need to be able to show people what we're doing. We also need to make progress. I think what we forget sometimes is that, look, what's the bigger risk? So, enabling older people to live well into old age in the community, right? We don't know how to do that. But we act as if simply continuing to do the things that we do know how to do is somehow going to address that problem. Now, what's the bigger risk? Is it a bigger risk to try and do a messy, you know, exploratory, experimental process that we're not sure of the outcome of the kind you've described, or to carry on doing things that we know ultimately don't work? Mm. And we get the risk of those the wrong way around all the time. I think that the kind of allowing ourselves to in ways that you know, we can't do this in everything all of the time, but just knowing that sometimes not knowing the answer is the best way to start.
And I think, from my experience, trying things immediately in the real world, and then if they don't work, stopping them quite quickly is so much better than spending years trying to get it perfect before anybody sees anything. But we do, our risk avoidance quite often means that we don't dare start in case it goes wrong. Well, it will go wrong, but when it goes wrong, we'll learn something, which means it'll go right later.
I have a lovely example of this. I did some work with a group of councils, public health, NHS, and community organisations in Derbyshire, who broadly were working around wanting to increase levels of physical activity and health. And they sort of came in knowing that most of the physical activity programmes that had always been run basically didn't make a difference, right? But that's what they knew how to do. So one of the bits of work involved me working with some people saying, well, look, rather than going and into a community and saying, okay, here is the exercise class, or here's the walking group, or whatever it might be, why don't you go in and just spend a few weeks just talking to people? Don't even talk to them about physical activity. Just talk to them about what matters to them. What do you mean? I mean, that's not work. That's, you know, but how am I going to tell my boss what I've done? What you mean, really? You just want me to have a conversation? And by the way, you know, we work with them about how to have a good conversation. Anyway, they did. They found it very hard. And one of the things that came out of it was they discovered a woman, and they were saying she was sort of one of these, you know, figures in a local community who everybody knows and everybody goes to and say, well, you must go and talk to so-and-so. And she said, well, you know what? What we really want, this kid down the road has been in an accident, and they need a whole load of equipment at home, and we're trying to raise money so that her mum can get the equipment at home. And if you can help us do that, that would be great. And out of that came actually what was, I'd never heard of it. It was a nighttime outdoor Zumba class with glow sticks, because none of the women wanted to be seen doing Zumba in the daytime. But it was sponsored, and they raised money for something they wanted to do. Now, and that then opened up a totally different conversation about what does it mean to work in, you know, with people in the reality of what matters to them. Yes, there was a physical activity thing that came out of that, but actually the whole process was totally different. And it sounds like a small thing, but it felt so risky for the people who were you know, local government public health officers, or who were, you know, commissioners in the CCG, to even allow that kind of process to unfold.
And it, you know, it's risky organisationally, but it's also risky individually, isn't it? If people are used to managing in a certain way and working in a certain way and the meetings happen in a certain way, we're asking people to take personal risks, to sort of behave differently, or to organise their meetings differently, or to say they don't know when people want them to know the answer. How do we get people to feel okay about taking those personal risks?
So I think this goes back to something we were talking about earlier about, you know, why do we want heroes? And I was saying it one of the things it does is absolves us of responsibility. I think it also allows us to imagine that we really are our roles and not actually fully rounded 360-degree human beings. So the sort of work that I was just describing, you can't go into, you know, a place, a community like the one we were working with, you know, and be the job. The only way you're gonna have conversations with people is if you are yourself. Now, your job is part of who you are, but you are, you know, you are more than that. You're a person with, you know, your own perspectives. You've got your own humor. You've got the values that motivate you. You've got all the things that make you you. And if you bring that into the work, then there's progress. But that's really exposing. That's really exposing. And we find that really hard. And I think we have to understand that that is a genuinely much harder, maybe a much ultimately more fulfilling and more worthwhile way of being in the world and being in our work. But it's not easy. And I think that when we're working in organizations that can be punitive, where there can be a blame culture, where there can be a sense of, you know, I need to mind my back, it's understandable that people think, well, if I just do the things that I am technically and formally responsible for, then at least I can't be criticized. So I think that is where we need to go. I think there are lots of places that are doing that, but I think it means that people who are responsible for, you know, particularly setting the kind of rules and regulations and the boundaries of organizational process, if they really want that change, they have to ask really serious questions about, you know, how do we recruit? How do we promote? How do we acknowledge? And how do we deal with, you know, this notion of failure? You know, that work that I was mentioning in Derbyshire, you know, there were lots of places where we did that where actually there wasn't the sort of outcome that I just mentioned. We had to try a lot before some things began to work. Now, you might see that as a failure and inefficiency and a lack of a waste of resources. I see that as a vital learning process for enabling progress to be made. And that's the difference between direction and technical and exploration and adaptive.